You're listening to Malice, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime, Three Men and a Mystery,
DNA ID, Riddle Me That,
All Things Crime,
and
Zodiac Speaking. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Predators. Their acts are evil. We call them monsters. We say no human could perpetrate the crimes they have committed. But in truth, only human beings execute these horrific acts. And if you're like me, you want to know why. I'm Ariel Cooksey, and this is Malice. The following episode contains some graphic descriptions of child abuse, child rape, child torture, institutional abuse and torture, attempted homicide, and homicide. If these issues may be triggering, please practice self-care and do not proceed. Nature versus nurture. That's really what this whole thing is about, isn't it? What causes violent offenders to do what they do? Are they born or created? I am of the mind that the two elements are inextricable. When we are born, our genetics have very few predetermined traits, but ultimately greater or lesser trait receptivity. For instance, a child might be born with greater receptivity towards socializing. Does that mean the child will be friendly? Not necessarily. It depends on what is fostered, encouraged, rewarded, and punished. A child on the other end of the spectrum with very limited trait receptivity towards socializing, however, is not likely to develop into a social butterfly, though the result is not impossible. The human mind is very malleable. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. No one is born evil. It is a complicated makeup of genetics and environment and socialization and experience and so many other factors. How much each factor weighs is hard to know. It's a complicated calculus with moving parts, and just as we find solutions, variables change, revamping the entire equation. But if there was ever a case for the weight of the nurture argument, this is it. Quote, "Is it unnatural that I should have absorbed those things and have become what I am today? A treacherous, degenerate, brutal human savage, devoid of all decent feeling, without conscience, morals, pity, sympathy, principle, or any single good trait? Why am I what I am?" His parents were Prussian immigrants, which was no glamorous life at the turn of the 20th century. Settled on a dirt farm in Minnesota, the soil upon which they lived was barely viable. The couple had no experience or knowledge of agriculture, and it showed. Though they were hardworking and strict, the family had little to show for their toils. The last of seven children, with five brothers and a sister, he began his farm chores as soon as he was physically capable. His brothers would often beat him without provocation, and he later reflected, quote, "Everybody thought it was all right to deceive me, lie to me, and kick me around whenever they felt like it, and they felt like it pretty regular." When school became compulsory by law, from age five he attended fastidiously, as did the rest of the children. But the barren farm still needed the same attention to produce even meager means for the family's survival. And so each day, he would start with chores, go to school, then return to continue working until the day's necessities were fulfilled. This was intense manual labor, and left the poor child exhausted and in pain. During this time, from kindergarten onwards, The child slept between 2 and 3 hours per night. His health suffered tremendously. Chronic fatigue affected his schooling in obvious ways. When he was called on in class, his teachers would become frustrated by his glazed over stares. He never played with the other children, likely more out of sheer exhaustion than any antisocial disposition. His fatigue worsened as he developed a chronic barking cough, which left his chest in pain and his breathing labored. Around this time, the young boy developed an infection in his ear. The swelling was so extreme, he was rendered deaf in that ear for the rest of his life. As if the pain wasn't excruciating enough on its own, the infection caused the boy's equilibrium to suffer, and his balance was badly thrown off. Having no means to see a doctor, his condition reached a point wherein he could no longer work, so his father used what limited skills he'd cultivated from tending to sick farm animals to attempt to extricate the infection. His brothers held him down on the dining table as he thrashed and screamed while his father dug into his ear with a kitchen knife. Despite his weakened state, his brother struggled to keep him still. He finally fell unconscious from the pain, which was later discovered to be a lucky thing. Based on the scarring, his father was just short of puncturing his brain. He was ripped out of his inert state when his father poured scalding water into his ear in his attempt to clean out the wounds and infection, resulting in third-degree burns in and around his ear. The child managed to break free, howling with pain, and upon a brother trying to restrain him, the boy punched him in the face. From that point forward, his self-control was essentially non-existent. It's possible during the course of this incident that the child suffered brain damage to his frontal lobe, the area of the brain responsible for impulse control. It is not known, however, and the radical departure in his disposition may have stemmed from having been traumatized by the perceived betrayal of those he was meant to trust. He began to suffer rage-filled outbursts and started to act out in other delinquent and dangerous ways. He regularly reacted violently to even the most imperceptible slights, beating other children, including his siblings. Despite the harrowing do-it-yourself surgery, the infection worsened as the knife wounds allowed the infection to spread into the child's brain, resulting in seizures. At the crux, the family had no choice but to hospitalize him, where he had to spend several weeks recovering. When he was 7, his parents' marriage had dissolved. At this time, and in their dire financial straits, exacerbated by the boy's medical needs, divorce was not an option. The courts couldn't assist, and alimony would have been laughable even if his mother had been awarded it. Instead, one day his father simply left and never returned. Left a single parent with a family of 7 children, their future was dismal. The farm, which already yielded very little in the way of financial return, had to be worked from dark hours of the morning to the dark hours of the evening. And yet, the harvests continued to be meager. His brothers began to find work outside the farm, with the expectation of helping to support the family, even moving off of the farm, which fell into disrepair. The boy, along with his mother and sister, simply couldn't keep up the labor on their own, and the child began to lash out when asked to help. With no other choice, his mother began to sell off pieces of the property. His brothers reneged on their agreement to send money home, having few fond memories of their childhood on the farm. Their parents, being overworked, were not emotionally present for their children, and the remainder of their recollections were childhoods filled with backbreaking labor. By age 8, he began to cut school in favor of wandering around town, growing ever more aware of the chasm between the upper and lower classes. While the wealthy enjoyed fine, comfortable living, the rest of the city was plagued by abject poverty, homelessness, and hunger. As a child, this made little sense to him, and he felt determined that he would have the things he felt he had been cheated by whatever means necessary. Around this time, he discovered his father's stash of liquor and proceeded to imbibe. He wound up in a skirmish with another child and was arrested for public intoxication. At age eight. Eight. The child showed signs of what we would now likely consider attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and had developed a penchant for lying, a trait we often see develop as a mechanism for survival. It could sometimes keep him from beatings. His deceitfulness extended to breaking into homes of the well-to-do and stealing whatever he could use. Early on, this mostly consisted of cakes and other treats, as he was constantly underfed. When he was 11, he broke into a neighbor's home and helped himself to a revolver he found in a glass vitrine. He wasn't the most cunning criminal, however, and when his brothers discovered the stolen gun, they beat him unconscious. He was arrested once more and sent to the Minnesota State Training School, which was intended to reform delinquent children. The crime listed in the institution's intake log was, quote, incorrigibility. Upon arrival, the warden informed the boy he was to be called Father. He was asked about his homosexual inclinations, but the boy had no idea what that meant. He later recounted the warden, quote, examined my penis and my rectum, asking me if I had ever committed fornication or sodomy, or had ever had sodomy committed on me, or if I had ever masturbated. Sodomy was also an unfamiliar word, so the administrator proceeded to describe the act in great detail, including what homosexual predators would do to him, much to the horror of the child. When satisfied, the warden sent the boy to become acclimated with his new living arrangements, but his welcome to the school foreshadowed only a mild version of what was to come. He had a reputation from the start for being violent and prone to engaging in fights, so the other boys tended to keep a wide berth, and he didn't face the same harassment and bullying of some of the less aggressive boys. His first morning on the campus, two guards escorted him to a building off the official campus of the school called the Paint Shop. The name was deceptive. The moniker stemmed from the children leaving, painted black and blue and bloody. This first time was considered an initiation of sorts. The intention was to show each child what would happen to them if they misbehaved in any way. The child was stripped naked and strapped to a wooden bench, where they draped a brine-soaked towel over his back. The guards proceeded to lash him with a specially designed belt with perforations that would draw his skin up with every whip. The effect was a constellation of blisters and welts. These fresh blisters would then be burst upon each successive lash, wherein the brine would seep into the open sores, stinging horrendously. The warden oversaw the beating, smiling more and more, the louder the screams and cries became. The child had never heard the term sadistic, but from this point forward, he knew the concept well. He realized his tormentors derived pleasure from his pain and humiliation, and grew silent in spite of the uptick in brutality as the frustrated men tried in vain to elicit a response. He gritted his teeth, refusing to give them gratification. Though the thrashing was intended to break the boys of any aggression or defiance of spirit, all it did to this boy was beat the weakness and empathy out of him. Without any skills or experience with the types of work expected of the inmates, the boy was assigned to the kitchen, where he would prepare meals for the staff. As the boys were consistently underfed, a theme by this point in the child's life, he unsurprisingly used the opportunity to steal extra food. When caught, he would be escorted back to the paint shop and brutalized. Some of his infractions included stealing a handful of sugar, taking an extra piece of fruit, and even being found with oats in his pocket. But he was determined to seek revenge. He proceeded to urinate into every liquid he could find and would masturbate into the food. Despite his above-average IQ, the child struggled with reading as he had limited formal education on the farm and was often overly tired in school. His inability to do so affected every subject, including biblical studies, and he was regularly beaten for this supposed infraction. Whereas the intervention of these courses was to instill a sense of morality and goodness, once again they missed the mark, with insipid dogma and rote memorization. His attitude was clear on the matter, and he began to be dragged to the paint shop daily, where he would endure more torturous beatings, as well as anal and oral rape. He recalled, quote, "I may not have accomplished much in a scholarly way while there, but I learned how to become a first-class liar in the beginnings of degeneracy." He loathed the guards and attendants who meted out punishment and developed a new view of religion as twisted and vile. Quote, "I was reformed all right. I'd been taught by Christians how to be a hypocrite, and I had learned more about stealing, lying, hating, burning, and killing. I had learned that a boy's penis could be used for something besides to urinate with it, and that a rectum could be used for other purposes." And still they couldn't break him. This was a time before background checks, and so many of the guards were uneducated and even had criminal records. They delighted in beating the children, and this boy was their greatest challenge. Typically, these sessions would end for the inmates when they couldn't take any more lashing. This child, however, wore out his tormentors, unwilling to make a single cry. But the exhausted guards decided they just needed to become more creative in their punishments. The warden procured a crank-operated paddling machine, which allowed for lengthier whippings without the same expense to the energy of the perpetrators. What they failed to consider is, because the device was mechanical, the contact of the paddle was identical with each stroke. The boy, like with repetitive noises to neurotypical people, could be tuned out after a while, as it was so predictable. As punishments began to once again include sexual violation and humiliation, he decided he would up the ante as well. He found the school's stash of rat poison and deposited a substantial dose into the warden's meal one evening. This could very easily have resulted in murder, but mercilessness would be repaid in kind. Or at least that was the intention. His plans were spoiled when the kitchen supervisor noticed the misplaced and open bag of rat poison. The child had mixed the toxic substance into the warden's coffee and was reported. For his infraction, he was finally transferred from the kitchen to the cleaning crew. The infuriated teen had learned a hard lesson while socialized in the school, that the weak will always be trampled by the powerful, and might makes right. He went on a spree, beating the younger boys, often to the brink of death. His punishment for the ordeal was the most brutal by far, but he remained silent and unmoved, even spitting in the face of one of the officers. In a desperate attempt to curb his aggression, the warden extended the boy's workload into the late evening, expecting he wouldn't have the energy to act out. There's no way they could have known this child was well-versed in the cycle of little sleep from his days on the farm. The chores he was tasked with were in no way comparable to the heavy, laborious load he was responsible for back at home. He would complete his responsibilities in relatively little time and delighted in having hours of free run of the campus grounds. With access to strong cleaning materials, he was able to concoct dangerous chemicals. He then used paint stripper to douse the paint shop, lighting it on fire. The building burned to the ground, an act of arson for which he was never discovered. I know. You may be thinking, aha, setting fires as a child, that's evidence of a future serial killer. Well, first of all, the McDonald Triad is not predictive. But secondly, this wasn't out of a sense of pleasure, whether one resulted from it or not. This was a cold, hard act of vengeance. When firefighters came out to inspect the damage, the warden was incensed, fearing the discovery of his implements of torture, would call attention to the flagrant abuse inflicted on the children in his care. The boy was considered a hero by his peers, and the older boys pulled him aside one day after lunch to express their gratitude by teaching him how to be paroled by the school. Essentially, all he had to do was lie and fall into line. Pretend to be reformed. Claim a change of heart. Tell the staff and warden what they wanted to hear. The 13-year-old returned to his life on the farm, but the formerly rambunctious child, never one to have many friends, had become sullen and brooding. His mother didn't take much of an active interest in the child, as her own circumstances had devolved as each child in turn left the farm and cut contact with her entirely. The only reason she had ever reached out to them was to ask for money, and they had no softness for her with which to bolster her pleas. And so it was just the two of them. He, a seething powder keg, she, as emotionally unavailable as she ever was. The farm had fallen into disrepair as his mother's isolation had led to a deep depression, and she couldn't muster the energy or motivation to tend to the crops. The once paltry produce disappeared altogether. Their cattle suffered, slowly starving to death, because they couldn't afford to regularly feed them. In an act of compassion, the teen euthanized the sick animals and found buyers for the others. They were destitute. One more reason to hate everything about that wretched place. Quote, "Mother was too dumb to know anything good to teach me," he said years later. "There was little love lost. I first liked her and respected her. My feelings gradually turned from that to distrust, dislike, disgust, and from there it was very simple for my feelings to turn into positive hatred towards her." As the farm inched ever closer to its imminent demise, the boy began to take up his old habit of walking around town, spending time with the other degenerates, especially those whom he could trouble for booze. The men didn't mind, as they found this boy with an astounding tolerance for alcohol to be amusing. In time, however, the novelty became old hat, and he had to move on. During this period, he was prone to stealing from his mother to keep up the habit, though when he realized her funds were dwindling at a record pace, he took to holding up his former classmates for what little pocket money they might have. He teamed up with a Native American boy in the town, a child whose ancestry made him a social pariah, and the pair wrought havoc on the young and vulnerable. His victims were not only robbed, but stripped naked and told to run, a sign of his growing sadistic desires. Inflicting humiliation was inextricable from pleasure. When his mother confronted him about the sudden influx of cash and perpetual stench of hooch on his breath, he told her he had decided to pursue the priesthood, as he had discovered the passion while in reform school. His mother pled with the local seminary to accept him into their theology program, along with requesting a bursary to pay for the schooling, and a week later, the teen was thrust into the world of scholarship. A child of gifted intelligence, he was praised by his classmates and instructors, described as witty and charming. But a visiting lecturer, a Lutheran priest from Germany, managed to see through the veneer and ascertained his glowing personality was merely a shell. The child had no faith at all in the hollow recesses within. Though abstractly able to discuss the finer points of morality, it simply wasn't grounded in any real conviction or calling. The priest set about doing anything he could to push the young man's limits, incessantly quizzing him, and although the child never slipped up, he grew agitated with the man's relentlessness. They began to argue, at first civilly, but escalating to altercations involving yelling, exactly what the priest had hoped to expose in the boy's nature. And just like so many times before, his punishment involved a heavy beating with a whip, the first of many in the institution. When he couldn't stand it any further, he managed to sneak a gun into the school, planning to shoot the priest in front of the class. But during another beating, The gun fell from his pants. He reached for it, trained it on the man right between the eyes, and squeezed the trigger. But there was no blast. He squeezed over and over, but still nothing. The gun was in poor repair and had jammed. Finally tackled by two teachers, he was expelled immediately. Quote, I fully decided when I left there just how I would live my life. I made up my mind that I would rob, burn, destroy, and kill everywhere I went and everybody I could, as long as I lived. 2 weeks would go by before he made the choice to hop a freight train and leave this life forever. More after the break.
My name is Bernadette, the host of Murderific True Crime Podcast. Murder plus horrific equals murderific. I cover some cases from the state of Maine in the United States and all over the world. Mass murders, domestic abuse, unsolved cases, serial killers, and mostly lesser known subjects. We don't shy away from the details, but we do that with all respect. This isn't entertainment. These are real people's lives, and I'm here to tell their story. Join me for my Season 5 reboot, and together we will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
Growing up as a latchkey kid in a small town in Maine, I always assumed I was safe. After all, unless it makes national news, murder isn't something people talk about around here. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Murder, She Told is a true crime podcast featuring crime stories, unsolved murders and missing persons, and baffling cold cases from my home state of Maine, New England, and small towns across America. These are the crime stories your hometown doesn't want to talk about, the mysteries buried deep in the newspaper archives of local American history. These are the homicides you've probably never heard of before. Through detailed storytelling and connections with family, friends, and investigators closest to the case, Murder, She Told will hit home for any true crime fan, whether you're from Maine or from away. Visit MurderSheTold.com to suggest your hometown crime story and subscribe now wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Kristen Seavey, and this is Murder, She Told.
Now, back to the show. Riding the rails was a dangerous proposition. A significant number of those whose practice was transients via the rail line did so to keep ahead of their criminal actions. The teen spent his time begging for food and stealing when he could, sleeping in freight cars, riding under the trains, and trying to avoid the railroad officers who could be even more terrifying than the outlaws. Many felt pity for the teen, hopeless at such a young age, and would offer what they could when they could. When the child took off on a freight train heading out of the state, he found four middle-aged men camping in a lumber car. These men were friendly and offered to buy him nice clothes and a place to sleep as they passed around a whiskey bottle. But there is, dear listeners, a difference between niceness and goodness. They were nice, but they weren't good. They told the child they wanted him to do a little something for them before treating him to the things they promised. One man told him it felt really good, and that they anticipated he would like it as much as they did. Each in turn removed their rope belts and stripped themselves of their tattered and soiled clothing. He didn't need further explanation. He knew what they had planned for him. He protested, to which he was given the response that that's not how it worked, and that he was the center ring of the circus, the one everyone wanted to see. The men proceeded to seize the boy, despite his protestations, hold him down, tore his clothes off, and bent him over stacks of hay. They took turns raping him, to their amusement and satisfaction, while the boy screamed, pushed back, bit their hands, and thrashed. He later recalled, quote, I cried, begged, and pleaded for mercy, pity, and sympathy, but nothing I could say or do could sway them from their purpose. He was desecrated for hours, finally too exhausted to really move. realizing they had essentially used him up. The men tossed his naked, bloody body out of the car while it was still moving, followed by his clothing and belongings. And with that lone, depraved act, the straw had finally broken the camel's back. Every ounce of goodness that may have remained in the boy's psyche disappeared. He tended to avoid tent cities, but given the extent of his injuries and the resultant pain, accompanied with his involuntary sobriety, caused him to approach a settlement of that sort in which he expected someone would likely have whiskey to pass around. Becoming friendly with a young man close to his age, he described his experience with the rape and the torturous feelings that accompanied it. The young man was fascinated by the story, and their conversation shifted from rape to consensual sex and the wellspring of pleasure it could elicit. They snuck off together, agreeing to take turns with each other, provided he was able to go first. But that wasn't part of the plan. His new companion summoned the others, and a circle of men formed around the intoxicated young man. They began to pass him around. He was too inebriated to fight back and fell unconscious. He had been gang-raped twice in a matter of 24 hours. But he had a reaction that might seem counterintuitive. He considered that if so many men were that eager to partake in the act of forced sodomy on boys, it must be one of life's great pleasures. As he continued on his journey riding the rails, he steered clear of any vagrants that weren't alone, and he began to rape. During a burglary, he was able to acquire another gun, with which he would force pairs of transients to sodomize each other at gunpoint. Once, when a railroad officer discovered the act, the young man ordered the transient to rape the officer. It wasn't long after that the teen was imprisoned for burglary and sent to another reform school for a year. By this point, at only 14, the teen was built like a man, with lean muscle and weighed nearly 180 pounds. He was immediately the target of scrutiny, as it took merely a couple weeks to earn the reputation as the most hardened inmate there. During his stay, his rapes didn't abate. He would single out the weakest boys among the bunch and use each boy for his sexual gratification. One guard in particular pushed the boy's limits, trying to make his life a living hell. One day, though, the teen had had enough. Quote, "He kept on nagging at me until finally I decided to murder him." And he did, in fact, attempt it. He found a wood plank outside one of the workshops and bludgeoned the unsuspecting man. He later recalled, quote, "For this I got several beatings and was locked up and watched closer than before." The walls were closing in. He couldn't take it anymore. He and a fellow inmate named Jimmy executed an escape, managing to steal several handguns before hopping the rails towards the next town. He and Jimmy had grown inseparable in the institution, and he was one of the few boys who didn't fight back. The teen actually had no idea what a functional sexual relationship looked like, and he felt he couldn't subject Jimmy to the sort of pain he inflicted. They spent about a month together riding the rails and wreaking havoc wherever they stopped. The teen taught his companion how to burn down buildings after they robbed a church. With each stop, they burglarized and burned down churches, a trend that would last throughout the rest of his life. He later quipped humorlessly, quote, "Naturally, I now love Jesus very much. Yes, I love him so damn much, I'd like to crucify him all over again." After their joint spree of stealing and burning, the two had acquired two handguns apiece and hundreds of dollars. But their Bonnie and Clyde routine had come to an end. Jimmy had attempted to sell a candlestick they had stolen from a church, but was found out and charged with larceny. By the time the teen had found out about his friend's fate, Jimmy was already en route to an adult prison. Holing up in a nearly lawless town where people still openly carried pistols in their belts and the rough Canadian fur traders and river fishermen created a rough environment, the 15-year-old was first struck by some semblance of direction. While drinking alone at a tavern one night, an army recruiter was giving a speech, and the boy lied about his age and enlisted. And it makes sense. He already had a penchant for violence, and this was an opportunity to do so with impunity, if it all worked out. But it didn't. Though he excelled in weapons training, his very first day in uniform, he was brought up on charges of insubordination for failing to comply with a work detail. He continued to be locked up regularly for petty offenses, often stemming from his drunk and disorderly behavior. It was impossible to rein him in, and military life is very much about compliance and order. The following year, he burgled the quartermaster's building and carried off $88.24 worth of clothing. His plan was to go AWOL and fence the items, but he was apprehended by military police. While in the stockade, he received a general court-martial before a military tribunal, where he pled guilty to 3 counts of larceny, a charge which, at that period in time, was considered treasonous. The punishment for his crime, according to court transcripts, states he was, quote, to be dishonorably discharged from the service of the United States, forfeiting all pay and allowances due him, and to be confined at hard labor at such place as the reviewing authority may direct for 3 years. This place turned out to be the notorious Leavenworth Prison in Kansas. Military prisoners were shackled to the inside of a cattle car, under the watchful supervision of armed guards. For the 1,000-mile trip, they were given neither food nor water. As they approached the looming building that would become their new home, the sight was almost breathtaking in its ominous countenance. The facility was surrounded by 40-foot-high walls, which disappeared a further 20 feet into the ground, and was situated on more than 1,500 acres. The inside of the prison alone accounted for 23 acres. The building was simply sprawling. When he walked through the doors, the guards had no way of knowing he was a mere 16 years old, shuffling in shackled and in leg irons. And so he was treated like any other prisoner, subjected to the enforcement of a strict code of silence intended to exert control over prisoners. If an inmate spoke out of turn, they would be beaten. Prisoners were in many ways expected to maintain their military rigor, standing in formation every morning, regardless of the weather. He was fitted with a 50-pound metal ball by a chain and forced to carry the ball everywhere he went, even during sleep. He spent 10 hours per day, 7 days a week, breaking rocks in a quarry, back-breaking labor. But guards had no idea how accustomed to this type of labor the teen was, having grown up on the farm. And so he kept his head down, did the work, all the while stewing in his desire for escape and vengeance. Following a failed escape soon after arrival, he placated himself by burning down one of the prison workshops, claiming to have caused over $100,000 worth of damage. Now, this might have been an embellishment, but it could also be he simply wasn't great with real estate appraisals. The figure was closer to $25,000 to $30,000. He was never charged with the crime, but that didn't stop the prison guards from torturing and beating him for any number of other infractions. Torture and rape were utilized as a means of keeping control, since the prison population far outweighed the staff tasked with monitoring their daily lives. The mindset was that if any crime or broken rule went unpunished, the prisoners would continue to push the envelope. Instead, they subdued the inmates with brutality and the threat of violence for those caught. He was beaten daily, several times to the brink of death, at which point the other inmates were expected to kill him. He was also subjected to wearing a straitjacket, which guards would secure so tightly he would faint from a lack of oxygen. Quote, I was discharged from that prison in 1910. I was the spirit of meanness personified. Well, I was a pretty rotten egg before I went there, but when I left there, all the good that may have been in me had been kicked and beaten out of me. but it wouldn't be the last time he would see the inside of those hated walls. By the later part of his sentence, he was said to be as strong as two inmates combined, and so tough he didn't respond to beatings at all. His fellow inmates admired him for his fortitude. When guards began to loosen his reins a little, he began to seek out the pedophiles who had targeted him in the beginning of his term. Faced with the intimidating man, they were powerless as he meted out what he felt was appropriate punishment for their abuse. He was released at the termination of his 3-year sentence, friendless, homeless, and penniless. From age 8 onward, the vast majority of his life had been spent imprisoned in some institution or another, all of which normalized violence and torture inflicted on the young man. The world was nothing more than hypocrisy, perversion, depravity, sadism, and coldness. How could he possibly think otherwise? In the words of former FBI profiler Jim Clemente, quote, "Genetics loads the gun, their personality and psychology aim it, and their experiences pull the trigger." It was all too much. He became the very spirit of hatred and vengeance. Over the short years following his release, he became a vagabond, drifting from state to state, using an alias. Cut from a very different cloth than before, he stood 6 feet tall, 195 pounds, almost exclusively muscle. He would never again be a victim of the transients he encountered, but would instead rape and beat those who tried his patience or simply became victim to his carnal urges. Quote, "Whenever I met one that wasn't too rusty looking, I would make him raise his hands and drop his pants. I wasn't very particular either. I rode them old and young, tall and short, white and black. It made no difference to me at all, except that they were human beings." He was arrested multiple times on charges for vagrancy, burglary, arson, and robbery, twice escaping his imprisonment. His fixation on burning intensified, by this point fully manifested in pyromania. He would burn down barns, sheds, fences, and when he couldn't find anything else, he would burn prairie grass or even the woods. His destruction was indiscriminate by this point. He simply needed to destroy. As he carried on with his home invasions, he always sought out guns first and claimed he always spent any spare change on bullets. He enjoyed taking shots at homes and windows, and if there were cattle or horses, he'd cut them loose just to wreak havoc. He was undoubtedly homosexual, though he would create myriad excuses for why he avoided involvement with women, including that he considered them unclean. On his trek to Colorado, he did rape a female vagrant, but the experience only solidified his presupposition as he contracted gonorrhea from the event. He was able to receive medical attention, but during the time his infection was clearing, he stole a bicycle which landed him in county jail on a sentence of 6 months. He was able to learn safecracking while incarcerated in exchange for protecting another prisoner. He broke into the jail once he was released to emancipate the safecracker, but it only served to have an additional month added to his original sentence. The older safecracker assumed the young man had broken into the jail because of a flirtation between them, and instead of teaching him more of the tricks of his trade, he kissed the young man on the mouth. When the man didn't react, the older man tried to undress him, but he was no submissive. In response to the come-on, he ripped the man from his jumpsuit, threw him onto the cold concrete floor, where he beat him mercilessly. The man was unable to even walk, forced to crawl back to his own cell. He served his 30 days before being released, digging up stolen guns he had buried outside of town, and hopping the next freight train. He discovered two other hobos in a boxcar. He admitted to sizing up the younger and best-looking one of the two and, quote, "figuring when to pull out my hog leg and heist him up." But when a railroad officer stumbled upon the three, he tried to extort money, threatening that he would boot them from the train. He clearly didn't know who he was messing with. The man, quote, pulled out my cannon and told him I was the fellow who went around the world doing people good. He forced the officer to relinquish his watch and money before raping him at gunpoint. He then coerced the other two to do the same, quote, using a little moral persuasion and much waving around of my pistol. When the violation had concluded, the man threw all three of them from the train. He continued his pattern of aggression, rape, and burnings the following years, taking what he wanted, or who, when he wanted it. His life would be lived on his terms entirely. He found employment as a bouncer for a traveling carnival, which appealed to him as he was a known brawler. Unfortunately, he ended up fighting nearly every man in the vicinity, and they finally cut him loose when a horse knocked him off balance, and he punched it so hard it was rendered unconscious. Furious, he returned in the night and set fire to two of the tents, one where the cooks slept, and the other filled with horses. When the staff of the carnival were alerted to the sounds of distressed horses, he was watching at a distance, reveling in the destruction. Not a single animal lived, and neither did the carnival. He once again hopped the rails, bound for another city in another state. Upon arriving, he crossed a picket line of railway workers striking. Unmoved by their plight, he was recruited by the railroad to act as a strike breaker. He had no sympathies nor loyalties, so a paycheck was a paycheck, and one that allowed him to exercise brute force on the strikers. He almost single-handedly broke the efforts as people began to return to their work to spare themselves his wrath. With his handsome wages, he furnished himself with a pair of guns he bought from a black market dealer and took on an accomplice, known as a punk or an Angelina. These young men were typically runaways, abducted, and forced into servitude. Among their roles were to serve as a carnal outlet and to assist in crimes, however instructed by their owner, or Yegg. Though he hadn't fully mastered safecracking, the man was able to earn consistent money through burglaries his punk would help out with. Their string of break-ins finally drew to a close when, during a robbery, the pair were apprehended and sentenced to work on a road crew. When another incarcerated man tried to exert his dominance by stealing the punk, the other sharing space with him refused to keep the teen there. They were terrified by the prospect of the wrath of the strapping young man with the empty, flaming eyes. Upon his attempt to escape the encampment, he was tied to a device referred to as the snorting pole and whipped viciously. This punishment involved him standing on his tiptoes, stripped of his clothing, and having his back lashed with snake whips, clad with lead weights at the ends. He stoically endured the torture without a sound. Recalling the aftermath of the incident, he claimed there was, quote, blood on my back and murder in my heart. When he was released, he made good on his escape, not even taking his punk with him. He would not be stopped. He would not be broken. He would survive, and he would take down as many of his fellow man as he could in the process. He hopped a train bound for Oregon, where he found seasonal work as a logger. His time in Oregon was marred with dozens of men and boys beaten and raped and robbed. His violence was indiscriminate, and he planned to take everything he could in order to fence it when he traveled south. Upon attempting to fence a stolen gold watch in a bar, he discovered his buyer was actually an undercover officer, and he once again found himself in court, staring down the barrel of a 7-year sentence for grand larceny. Though told that by detailing to officers all of the items he had stolen and where to find them, he would be released, this was a lie. The judge felt he was an unrepentant social malignancy and a repeat offender, and that he deserved every moment behind bars. Though his reputation in various institutions before had preceded him, Oregon was different. He was quick to right any misconceptions they had about him as a potentially submissive prisoner, however. He knew showing weakness was the worst possible thing he could do, and his very first day he filled his chamber pot before throwing it onto the first guard with whom he made contact, earning him a relentless beating until he was rendered unconscious. His surly disposition earned him the ire of the guards, who were largely unconcerned with prisoners who acted out of line. The crude prison was notorious for corporal punishment, including whippings, hosings, beatings, starvation, and solitary confinement. During his time in captivity, he was disciplined for even minor offenses, often being shackled to walls or hung from rafters for hours at a time, sometimes even days. They would submerge prisoners in bathtubs before applying electric shocks. The whips they used were cat-o'-nine-tails, a flail with nine cords outfitted with metal barbs intended to rip the flesh when making repeated impacts. The man recounted that his brutal punishment became so frequent, it was routine. One offense in his record states he was, quote, hung 10 hours a day for 2 days for hammering, rising a disturbance in cell, and cursing an officer. Merely a month later, he faced the same abuse for 12 hours a day for going on another tier from where he cells and having a dangerous weapon, a billy, or a sap. When guards found him in possession of a blackjack, he was thrown into what were called the dungeons for 3 weeks on meager rations of bread and water. During this time, they, quote, stripped us naked and chained us to a door, and then turned the fire hose on us until we were black and blue and half blind. This torture did nothing to abate his oppositional defiance. Upon an escape where he successfully sawed through the bars of his cell, he rampaged within the prison, stuffing rags into keyholes to slow the movement within and beat the guards unconscious before setting the workshop on fire. The entire prison population had to be evacuated. Upon successfully emptying the building, he was thrown to the ground where they broke his ankles with hammers. He did 61 days in solitary confinement in near complete blackness, resorting to eating cockroaches to sustain him. His bones mended without being set, and so were, from that point forwards, crooked. Returned to his cell, he became hell-bent on escaping for real, which, after several attempts, he finally succeeded. He had gained notoriety even outside the prison walls, however, and was quickly identified by a sheriff's deputy. Prior to facing off against the officer, he had stolen a loaded .38-caliber handgun and unloaded the clip on the pursuing officer. He ran out of ammunition and was ultimately recaptured, but the fight in him wasn't yet snuffed out. He proceeded to try to wrest the officer's gun while inside the police car, resulting in a violent struggle. The rear windows of the car were kicked out, and shots were fired through the roof. He was returned to solitary confinement, bloody and unconscious. The following year, he once again escaped from Oregon prison, having sawed through the bars on his window using a hacksaw blade, which undoubtedly led to the prison reevaluating their one hacksaw per prisoner policy, before jumping the walls and taking off into the woods. Despite the massive attempts to gun the man down as he fled, the officers were unsuccessful, and the man hopped the rails once again, this time to head for the East Coast. The deluge of his hatred for humanity was just beginning. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'm so humbled by your ongoing support and encouragement. I hope you will also join me tomorrow for part 2, where this violent offender gets a taste for taking human life. Until then, I'm Ariel Cooksey, and this is Malice.